Okay, thank you. So my talk will be devoted to some recent work on the symmetry structure of gravity, which has been triggered by the analysis by Belinsky, Lifshitz, and Kalatnikov of the gravitational field equations in the vicinity of a space-like singularity. So it turns out that one can show, and this is what I will review in this lecture, in this talk, one can show that this BKL behavior is controlled by an infinite-dimensional infinite-dimensional Lie algebras of Kac-Moody Lorentzian types. I will explain these words later on. And this suggests that perhaps these algebras themselves are symmetries of gravitational theories. So what I will do in this talk is first review the BKL work, but in a sense this is really a pretext for what comes next. And I will review the BKL work in a language which is appropriate to see the emergence of infinite-dimensional Kac-Moody algebras. And then I will describe recent attempts to go beyond that and make the symmetry suggested by these findings manifest. I will also say a few words on recent work on quantum correction that seem to fit into this Kac-Moody pattern. Okay, so what is the context? Well, I will be discussing rather general theories, so only bosonic sectors, so only bosonic fields here. I will say a few words about fermions if I have time later on. So which contains gravity, so this is a space-time metric, a bunch of dilatons, there might be none, there might be a couple of them, and a collection of p-forms. So this is a schematic form of the action. So you have the Einstein-Hilbert term, the kinetic term for the dilatons, perhaps dilatons, if there are many of them. Then you have the p-forms, which have couplings to the dilatons, and there might be additional terms, which will be important for the symmetry, for making the symmetry manifest, but for the BKL analysis, which is a rough first approximation, as we will see, they are not important. So now what are these terms? Well, if you have one forms with Young-Mills couplings, well, I would put these coupling terms into more. If there are Chern-Simons term, I put that into more. Chaplin-Monton types of terms, they are also into more. I mean, they are not important for the billiard, although they would be important for when we go beyond the billiard. Okay, now this action, or this type of action, contains indeed the massless sectors of all string theories, bosonic part at least. But for what I'm going to say first, what is really important is that we have gravity into the picture. The fact that this could be the bosonic sector of a supersymmetric theory is not essential, at least for the first part of the analysis. Okay, so I will first review BKL, Belinsky, Lifshitz, Kalatnikov, but in a way that is appropriate to see this, the first hint of the symmetry. So what Belinsky, Lifshitz, Kalatnikov did was to study in four dimensions pure gravity in the vicinity of a space-like singularity. Well, they call that cosmological singularity because they had in mind the Big Bang, but the analysis applies also to future singularities, which may be actually inside black holes and of the Schwarzschild type. So what they wanted to do is to construct the general solutions in the vicinity of such singularities. So not particular solutions with fine-tuned initial conditions, but the general solutions with arbitrary initial condition forming a singularity. Okay. And to discuss that, well, they adopted a coordinate system. I should say from the outset that the BKL work is very suggestive, but mathematically, some of the assertions I will make have not been proven yet. Nevertheless, I will not. They are educated. These are educated conjectures. There is a lot of support for what they have done, but it's not fully proved. But I will not talk about the mathematical aspects here. I will proceed as if things had been proved. There is also a lot of numerical support in favor of the BKL work. So but this is not what I will discuss here. Okay, so they assume that there is a space-like singularity. It might not go cover all of space. I mean, this is really a local analysis in the vicinity of some singular region. And in order to study the behavior of the field, they use a Gaussian coordinate system adapted to the singularity. So the singularity is if t is equal to zero, and then you march orthogonally with equal amounts of proper times everywhere. So that defines the coordinate system in which you are going to study the dynamics. And the dynamics is described by the spatial metric on those slices, the dilatons if they are dilatons, the conjugate momenta, I will adopt a Hamiltonian description, and then the form, if there are p-forms, well, you would have the p-form field variables present as well. And we want to study the equations as one goes to the singularity, which I have taken here to be in the past, a Big Bang type, just as Belinsky, Lifshitz, and Kalatnikov did. Okay. Now, it's convenient to parameterize the metric in terms of scale factors. So I will parameterize the special metric in terms of, I will diagonalize it using the Gram-Schmidt orthogonality procedure that's known in group theory, the Iwasawa decomposition of Gij. And so these would be the scale factors in three independent directions. And actually, if they are dilatons, I also include them among the scale factors. So I will have a collection of scale factors. And all the other variables, so the off-diagonal components of the metric which are contained in these frame fields here, as well as the p-form variables, I will collectively call them off-diagonal variables. And what Belinsky, Lifshitz, and Kalatnikov showed in four dimensions, but that can be extended to higher dimensions, is that in the limit where you go to the singularity, all the off-diagonal variables freeze, I mean they go to constant, and really the interesting dynamics is in the scale factors. And moreover, they have shown that the dynamics of the scale factor in the limit is controlled by ordinary differential equations as opposed to partial differential equations. And so you have at each spatial point a finite dimensional dynamical system. So there is an effective decoupling as you go to the space-like singularity of the spatial points. The singularity? Where? Well, it's at t equal to zero, and the spatial, I mean, the information is contained in the fact that the volume goes to zero. Okay, so I will actually study the equations when the sum of the betas goes to infinity, I mean, with this minus sign here. And then, furthermore, well, they've shown. Well, actually, it's really in four dimensions. That was done by Chitre and Misner, but that again can be generalized to higher dimensions relatively straightforwardly. But the dynamics of the scale factors, which are the things which do not freeze, which do not tend to limits as you go to the singularity, is equivalent to the dynamics of a billiard ball moving in a region of hyperbolic space. So I will give you a hint on how this is derived. I will not go through all the detail because I would like to go to get quickly to the underlying symmetry. But one can understand a lot without going into the details. So to understand this statement that there is a billiard in a region of hyperbolic space which is relevant as you go to the singularity, let me remind you that the space of the scale factors has some interesting structure which comes from the Hamiltonian of general relativity, which is quadratic in the momenta. So because it's quadratic in the momenta, it means that it induces a metric named by De Witt supermetric in the space of the metric. And if I restrict this to the diagonal components, so to the scale factors, this Hamiltonian has the following form. So it corresponds to the following metric. What is important is that this metric in the space of scale factors is of Lorentzian signature. And the conformal factor corresponds to the time-like direction, and then all the rest would correspond to space-like motion. So so this metric here, which is defined by the Hamiltonian of general relativity, as well supplemented by what you get from the dilatons, as a Lorentzian signature, there is a minus sign, but only one, and that corresponds to conformal transformations. Now, the scale factors are not all independent because of the Hamiltonian constraint. So this is, I mean, this is the space of scale factors. But because of the Hamiltonian constraint, there is one relationship among the scale factor at each point. So I'm now, because of dynamics decouple, I'm just focusing on one particular but arbitrary spatial point. And so this is a space of scale factors, and I want to study the behavior as I go in that direction, which is a BKL limit. And it's convenient to take into account the Hamiltonian constraint by projecting onto the hyperboloid. And so this is a representation of the hyperbolic space. So you can have also a Poincaré. So if by a conformal transformation, you can use a Poincaré disk representation. So I will use both representations to discuss the dynamics. Now, the number of dimension of hyperbolic space relevant to the problem is, well, the number of scale factors, of spatial scale factors, which if you are in 11 dimensions, for instance, you would have 10 scale factors. But then there is one constraint, so you have 9-dimensional hyperbolic space. For gravity, pure gravity in d dimensions, you would have d minus 1 scale factors and one constraint at d minus 2 hyperbolic, d minus 2-dimensional hyperbolic space. Okay, now what is the dynamics of these scale factors? Well, it's controlled by the Hamiltonian of general relativity, so which I have symbolically written as the sum of two terms. Well, the kinetic term for the scale factors, which I had written explicitly in a few transparencies ago. And then all the rest I call V. It acts as a potential for the scale factors. So all the rest means the kinetic energy of the off-diagonal metric components of the p-forms. So that would be like centrifugal potential. But then there is also the spatial curvature, which is here. You have also the gradient, spatial gradients of the p-form, so the magnetic energy of the p-form. So everything I put here. And what follows from BKL, of course, there is a good deal of work behind that, so I'm just giving you the result, is that as you take the limit, it goes to zero, so the volume goes to zero, this potential, which actually is a sum of exponential, well, the exponential comes sharper and sharper, and in the limit, you get a sum of sharp wall potentials. So this is the infinite step function, which is zero when the argument is negative and which is infinite when the argument is positive. So the potential in the limit, as I said, I'm not going to show that here, but you have to take my word for it or BKL words for it. This is zero when you are on the positive side of the wall, and this is infinite on the other side. And what is interesting is that these are just linear forms in the betas, which means that if you are in a region where all these linear forms are positive, well, this would be negative then, and the potential would be zero. The dynamics would be controlled by the kinetic energy term only, so it would be a free motion. But then at some point, you would hit one of these walls where the Ws are zero, and there would be a reflection against these walls, and then there would be a free motion again. So the motion will be a succession of free flight motions in hyperbolic space, interrupted by collisions against the appropriate wall that you are hitting. And there are really two possibilities if you draw everything on the conformal Poincaré disk representation. The region which is bounded by the wall could be of finite volume, or it could be of infinite volume. Now, it is known that if it has finite volume, well, the geodesic, well, these are really geodesic, so it should not be straight lines, should be arcs of circles. So it's known that the geodesic motion in a portion of hyperbolic space which has finite volume is chaotic, and actually that corresponds to the so-called mixed master behavior which had been found by BKL and Misner. However, if the volume is infinite, there are directions of escape, and after a few collisions, you can go to infinity freely, And you can show actually that the free motion, the geodesic motion, and that was known by to De Witt already, the free motion is just the Kastner solution. So the Kastner solution is really a geodesic in that space.
Mark,
yes?
In the original mixmaster context, I'm used to thinking about this as being walls within geodesic sort of flat space. Is that a mistake I've been making, or is there?
Well, this would be the non-projected. Okay, you could have, yes. So you could have a motion in flat space, and I'm just projecting everything on the hyperboloid.
Flat space,
that's right.
Okay.
Yes.
It's a stupid question. So, if you look up, I mean, again, let's suppose you're approaching some cosmological singularity. I mean, this billiard takes place for a while, and then it just pops when you hit the singularity.
Okay, I will. Of course, when you approach a singularity, curvatures blow up, and you cannot really trust the classical equations of motion. So, I will comment on that later on.
But the time that you're using for this dynamical problem goes to infinity at the singularities. So even if there's an infinite number of bounces, you still go through all infinity of them before you get the same.
Yeah, I should have said, well, it was written, but I should have commented. I'm taking the logarithm of the property, and the appropriate time to describe this is the logarithm of the proper time. Actually, even the logarithm of the logarithm of the proper time. That goes to infinity. Okay, so you may ask the question, when are you in that situation and when are you in that situation? Actually, I should say that when you are in that situation, things are simpler because you settle after a while into a Kastner behavior. And actually, you can really, in that case, show theorems that state that the BKL analysis is indeed correct. Okay, because in other words, you can show that indeed this velocity-dominated behavior described by asymptotic Kastner is the general behavior when the billiard has infinite volume. The tough part from the mathematical point of view is that one. Sorry?
The infinite volume case, you can show that the Kastner behavior, the BKL behavior is exact mathematically. Is it still true that each point decouples, or is there X point uniform over some sets?
Yeah, it's true that the points decouple, but you assume that you have smooth initial data, so the Kastner exponents will, at least initially, yes. Okay, and let me just, I would like to go to the symmetry, which is, I think, the most, at least, for me, the most interesting part. Well, one can ask the question, for which theories do you have a finite volume? For which theories do you have an infinite volume? Well, the walls that you will get depend on the theory. And because some of the walls will come, as we have seen, from the kinetic energy of the p-forms. So depending on the collection of p-forms, you will get that or that wall. Okay, now you can show that for pure gravity, if you take pure gravity, you get a finite volume billiard as long as the space-time dimension is smaller than or equal to 10. But you get an infinite volume billiard, and so no chaos, if the space-time dimension strictly exceeds 10. And I think that this is probably to be related to the talk of Kohl, who had also this 10 appearing in his discussion. But okay. So there is this critical qualitative change as you increase the space-time dimensions. If you have just gravity plus a scalar field, then it's always an infinite volume. But if you put p-forms, and in the space-time dimension in which the p-forms are not dual to a scalar field, then it has finite volume. So the p-forms tend to make the volume smaller and finite, but the scalar field infinite volume. So when you have the two together, p-forms and scalar fields, depending on the values of the Dilaton couplings, which are continuous parameter, you can show that if the couplings are small enough, then the volume is infinite. But as you increase the couplings, the volume will become finite.
So I forget how those are derived. Is there a direct connection to your numerology of supergravity or not, or any others?
10. I mean, oh, is 10 equal to 10?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with how it comes out of.
Ah, no, here, I mean, the derivation of that seems to be completely orthogonal to supersymmetry considerations, although one has a belief that they might be some deep connection. Okay, I come back to that.
Rephrase Steve's question. Are there supergravity theories in both categories, in the finite volume, or are they all in one thing?
Okay, supergravity is always in the finite volume case. I mean, yes. Okay. This is not what I wanted. In particular, the supergravity theories related to string models are always on the mixed master side. And of course, the P forms are crucial in 11 dimensions. It's because of the three forms that you are, without the three form, you would be in a non-chaotic infinite volume case. But there is an additional wall brought by the P form, which makes the volume finite.
Lots of matter.
Yeah, we have computed the billiards for all these things. I can. Okay, so there is, and I think this is very intriguing and worth investigating. There is a connection between the billiards that we find through the BKL construction and Lorentzian Kasmudi algebras, and this is what I would like to explain now. So for pure gravity in any space-time dimension, for supergravity models, you find that the billiard region has remarkable regularity properties. First of all, it's a simplex. Now, this is not completely obvious, because if I take, for instance, the case of 11-dimensional supergravity, we have a number of walls which is of the order of 800 or 900. But of course, some of the walls are behind others and are not relevant. So if you only look at the relevant walls that define the positive, I mean, the billiard table, you find that it is a simplex. So many walls are behind. But then not only do you find a simplex, but you find that the angles between the hyperplanes are integers of multiples of pi. And I mean, for theories where you have Dilaton couplings, which is a continuous parameter, in general, for arbitrary values of the couplings, you would find that you don't get an integer a multiple of pi, but for supergravity theories, you always find an integer multiple of pi. And then if you compute this matrix, and we'll see why it's interesting to compute that matrix, you find that this matrix of the scalar product between the wall forms, and you compute the scalar products using the metric in the space of the scale factors, you find that this is a Cartan matrix of a Lorentzian Kasmudi algebra. And you get Lorentzian because of the conformal factor. Yes, I'm just taking the relevant walls, which actually will correspond to simple roots. The ones behind will be non-simple positive roots. And if the volume is finite, well, in terms of Kasmudi algebra theory, that corresponds to the fact that the Kasmudi algebra is hyperbolic. I will say a few words about this in a second. Let me continue discussing, I mean, telling you what are the translation rules. So the scale factors in that picture would correspond to Cartan degrees of freedom. So they would be define the point in the Cartan subalgebra of the Kasmudi algebra. The walls would correspond to simple roots. I mean, the walls defining the simplex would correspond to simple roots, and the reflection against the wall would correspond to a veil reflection in the Cartan on the Kasmudi side. So let me say a few words about Kasmudi algebras, but I will have to be cryptic because of time. So Kasmudi algebras are generalizations of ordinary finite dimensional simple Lie algebras, in which you give up some properties, but you don't throw everything overboard. You keep one important property, which is the triangular decomposition. So how is this done? Well, you define the Kasmudi algebra by a Cartan matrix. So you have to give a matrix, which is an R by R matrix, which is, which has two on the diagonal, and which has non-positive integers of the diagonal. Now, the metric needs not be symmetric, but the condition is that if Aij is different from zero, Aji is also different from zero. Now, I will not take arbitrary Cartan matrices here. I will assume, because that's a relevant case for gravity, that the matrix has non-vanishing determinant. So when the determinant is zero, and if it's positive semi-definite, that's the affine case. So that needs some special treatment, but I will not give it here. And I will also assume that the matrix is symmetrizable, which means that it can be written in this way, where this is symmetric. So there is some symmetric. By rescaling the directions, you can make it symmetric. So it's called symmetrizable. And then the size of the matrix, R bar R, R is called the rank of the algebra. Now this matrix completely defines the algebra, so there is a notation to encode the information contained in the matrix through Dynkin diagrams, which, let's take. So the idea is that you have as many nodes as the rank of the matrix, and you connect two nodes when, so for instance here I connect node 1 and node 2, because in position 1, 2 I have a non-vanishing integer. And actually, the number of lines which I draw is the greatest in absolute value of the two. So here I have three. I have three lines, and then I put an arrow that goes from 2 to 1, because a12 is greater in absolute value than a21. So these are the rules, the familiar rules from Lie algebra theory, and that's a way to encode the Cartan matrix, which defines completely the Lie algebra. Okay, so I will often, instead of writing explicitly the Cartan matrix, I will often use the Dynkin diagrams. Now, the algebra is abstractly defined in terms of 3R generators, which correspond to familiar concepts. You would have first the Cartan generators, R of them. So this would be the analog of J3, say, in SU2. And then you have raising operators. And then you have lowering operators, and these are subject to a collection of relations, which involve the Cartan matrix. So these commutes, the E's and the F's, raising and lowering operators, are eigenvalues under the adjoint action of the Cartan generators, and the eigenvectors are just the entries in the Cartan matrix. And then if you commute a raising with a lowering operator, you hit the Cartan subalgebra, and things are normalized so that we have this. So these are the Chevalet relations, then, and these are really the source of the difficulty in handling the Kac-Moody algebras. You have also Serre relations on the generators, which is that if you compute the multi-commutators of EAJ with EJ with EI, 1 minus AIJ times, you get 0. So this is what is written here, and the same on the lowering operator side. Okay, now these relations are interesting because they define an algebra which admits a triangular decomposition. So the idea is that you have to include in the algebras all the commutators, and the only relations that you are allowed to use to simplify things is the relations I have written. Then you can show that the algebra has a triangular decomposition familiar from finite dimensional Lie algebra theory. In terms of three subalgebras, you have first the Cartan subalgebra, which contains the H's. It's finite dimensional. Then you have the multi-commutators of the E's. And this might not stop, so you may have an infinite number of multi-commutators on this side. And you would have an infinite number of multi-commutators on the lowering side. Now, these multi-commutators are eigenvectors for the adjoint action of the Cartan generators. So this defines for you the roots. And you have, again, you can define the concept of positive roots, negative roots, simple roots. And all the roots would be linear combination. All the positive roots would be linear combination with positive integer coefficients of the simple roots. So you have a lot of the structure of finite dimensional simple Lie algebras go through. But there are also many things which are fully understood. You can define an invariant scalar product, which is the analog of the Cartan-Killing scalar product. If that scalar product is positive definite, actually the algebra is finite dimensional. But if it's not positive definite, the algebra would be infinite dimensional. And the case which is of interest to us is when it has Lorentzian signature, because we will identify that scalar product with a scalar product in the space of the scale factors. Okay, now, there are many things which are similar to finite dimensional Lie algebra theory, but there are also complications. One of the complications is that the roots might be, if you have Lorentzian signature, you can have time-like roots, you can have space-like roots, you can have null roots. So roots which are not space-like are called by Katz imaginary roots, and a complication is that these imaginary roots can come with a non-trivial multiplicity. It's known that for finite-dimensional Lie algebra, roots come with multiplicity 1. Here you can have a non-trivial multiplicity, and actually the multiplicity explodes as you increase the height. Okay, but I'm not going to do Katz-Moody algebra theory here. Let me just mention that we can also define for a Katz-Moody algebra the concept of veil, of the veil group. You start with the simple roots, then you consider the fundamental veil reflections, which are just ordinary reflections in the hyperplanes orthogonal to the simple roots. And then the fundamental veil chamber would be the region in the space of in the Cartan, or in the dual of the Cartan subalgebra, so in root space, which is on the positive side of each of these reflecting hyperplanes. So these are defined, when this is equal to zero, you have the reflecting hyperplane. For instance, for SU3, here are the famous, the simple roots of SU3, so alpha 1 and alpha 2, which makes an angle of 120 degrees. And then the veil chamber would be that region here, which is a fundamental region for the veil group, which is the group generated by these veil reflections. But we can do the same for any Katz-Moody algebra. And in the case when the scalar product is Lorentzian, so the case relevant to us, well, the veil group then would not be a discrete subgroup of On, but it will be a discrete subgroup of On minus 1, 1, actually of the orthochronous, time orientation preserving part, because simple roots are space-like, so the hyperplanes are time-like, so you are reflecting in a time-like hyperplane, and that preserves time orientation. And you can either describe the action in Minkowski space or on hyperbolic space. And the fundamental veil chamber will define a region in hyperbolic space. And that region will have finite volume if and only if the algebra is hyperbolic. Well, actually, that can be viewed as a definition of hyperbolic Katz-Moody algebra. But the interesting thing is that hyperbolic Katz-Moody algebras exist only up to rank 10. So you cannot construct hyperbolic Katz-Moody algebras above rank 10. And in rank 10, there are only four of them, which are listed here. E10, B10, C10, and D10. So I'm only giving the Dynkin diagram from which you can read the Cartan matrix.
So one is, in the case of interest for gravity, especially when you have these scaling dynamics, you're going to tell us that the roots all form the simplex. So in that case, why is there an non-trivial bottle chain?
Maybe I can show you the case relevant to gravity. So this is the case relevant to gravity. So I've drawn all the walls, there are six of them. Three comes from the off-diagonal kinetic turn for the metric. They are so-called centrifugal or symmetry walls. There are these three. So there are hyperplanes, and this is just the intersection of these hyperplanes with the hyperboloid, and then I compactify on the Poincaré disk. And then you have terms coming from the spatial curvature. These are known as gravitational walls, and these would correspond to these three walls here. And you see that even though you have six walls, only three of them are relevant. If you are on the positive side of this one, positive side of this one, positive side of this one, you are automatically on the positive side of this one. So this one is behind. So of the six walls, only three are relevant. If you compute the Cartan matrix, you find that this is just the Cartan. This defines, and this is what it is. And actually, the veil group in that case is just PGL2Z. Okay, I don't know if that answers your question. And the veil chamber is just this. And these walls would correspond to the simple roots, and these would correspond to higher roots.
But are all the simple roots space-like?
Yes, because you have always a plus 2 on the diagonal. So it's Yeah, in this, for ordinary Kasmudi algebras, they are always space-like, so the hyperplanes are always time-like, so they always intersect the unit hyperboloid. Mm-hmm. Well, there is a nicer picture here, but it's the same. So it's nice because it's related to some tiling of hyperbolic space. And so this is something which has been much studied by mathematicians, but it has the same content of information as the previous transparency. Okay. Now, you might ask the question, what type of Kasmudi algebras do you get? And I realize that I will have to shorten what I wanted to say. Let me say that what you get are actually, for all theories, well, the Kasmudi algebras which appear in the Billiard is simply related to the dual, to the group which appears when you do the toroidal compactification to three dimensions. So you know that for all these theories, when you reduce to three dimensions, and you dualize everything that can be dualized to scalars, so you would have gravity coupled to a nonlinear sigma model composed containing all the scalars. So if you do that for 11-dimensional supergravity, for instance, you would get in three dimensions gravity coupled to scalars which are on coset space of E8 over SO16. So the group that you obtain in the Billiard is the so-called overextensions of the group which appears in three dimensions. So in the case of E8, that is what you get in three dimensions. This would be the affine extension, so-called E9, which actually is the analog of the Gerard group. That's what you would get in reducing to two dimensions. And the group controlling the Billiard is just the one, I mean, you extend it further, and this is known as the overextension of the algebra. So for E8, you would get E10, which is this. So for 11-dimensional supergravity, you get E10. And for all... Yes?
When you say this group appears in three dimensions, is the statement that when you reduce it on a fourth three dimensions, this group is an exact symmetry?
If you reduce on a torus,
yes.
11-dimensional supergravity,
yes.
And if you dualize, then the Lagrangian is the Lagrangian of gravity coupled to a nonlinear sigma model, and this nonlinear sigma model as E8 has a symmetric group. So this reduced Lagrangian has that symmetry.
But the Kasmudi algebra is actually the one you get reduced into one dimension.
Well, if you reduce to one dimension, nothing is left. That's the problem. So it's not exactly reducing to one dimension, because if the fields depend only on time, you get a finite number of variables depending on time, so there is no symmetry algebra. So in a sense, we do get something that is reminiscent of dimensional reduction to one, but we get more. Okay, and this is what I would like to describe now. So, but maybe I can, for instance, for Q-gravity in D dimensions, the Kasmudi algebra you get is, well, this would be affine. Yeah, I mean, without this node, that would be the affine extension of a D minus 2, and this would be the overextended node. And it's known that this algebra is hyperbolic. A7++ is hyperbolic, but A8++ is non-hyperbolic, and this accounts for the fact that you go from finite volume to infinite volume as the dimension go from 10 to 11. So there is a group theoretical understanding of that. Well, I don't know understanding, but a reformulation of that. For 11-dimensional supergravity, this is what you get. If you take 10-dimensional supergravity, n equal 1 supergravity with one Maxwell multiplet, well, the group in three dimensions is B8, SO9-8. So this is the Lie algebra that you would get for the Billiard. I mean, you would get the, let's see, this is the affine node, and this would be the overextended node. For pure supergravity without Maxwell multiplets, you get D8, SO88, and then the so the Billiard that you would get would be the overextension of D8. So this is the affine node, and this would be the overextended node. Okay, so the natural question to be asked is whether this fact that you get a nice billiard when you do the BKL analysis, whether it signals a huge symmetry or whether it's just an accident. And so we have tried to make the symmetry manifest. So we assume that the symmetry was present and we have tried to make it manifest with only partial success, but let me tell you what works and what doesn't work and what the idea is. So in a sense, the idea was that the reason why we only see the veil group and not the full algebra is because we kept only the Cartan diagonal degrees of freedom. But if we had kept also the off-diagonal degrees of freedom, maybe the symmetry would have been more apparent. And an analogy with this is, consider a theory of unitary matrices, which is, so these are SUN matrices, which is invariant, so M would be the dynamical variables, and assume I have a Lagrangian which is invariant under SUN conjugation. So SUN would be a symmetric group of the theory. Now we know that using the symmetry I can diagonalize the matrix, and because every SUN matrix is diagonalizable, in group theory language it's conjugate to a Cartan element. And once you have diagonalized, so if you only look at the diagonal elements, the signature of the fact that you had SUN as symmetric group is that actually the veil group of SUN is present. And the veil group is just a permutation group. So if we drop the off-diagonal degrees of freedom, we don't see the full SUN, but we only see the veil group of SUN, which is a permutation of the eigenvalues. No one tells you which one is first, which one is second, etc. So the idea was that maybe if we keep the off-diagonal degrees of freedom, not just the scale factors, but also the other variables, then we would be able to write the Lagrangian in a form where the symmetry, this overextended symmetry, would be more apparent. And so we have tried to rewrite the equations of, let's say, 11-dimensional supergravity as nonlinear sigma model equations for, in that case, E10. Now, the manifold that one considers is not the manifold of E10, but the symmetric space E10 quotientized by the compact, maximal compact subgroup of E10. So just like as if we were dealing with SL2, what would be the analog would be SO2, so we would be considering SL2 over SO2, which is hyperbolic space. Okay, so we want to do something similar here, and we want to compare the geodesic motion on this infinite dimensional space, so which is, let's say, E10 over K of E10, with the equations of 11-dimensional supergravity. And I think I will have to tell you how this goes, but quickly. So for a nonlinear sigma model, you can write a Lagrangian. It's just standard kinetic term, which is invariant under right multiplication by an element of the group. So we would have a Lagrangian. I'm considering the quotient space of G++ divided by the compact subgroup of G++, which means that I identify a group element with, and I'm assuming that K acts on the left, and identifying G with HG, where H belongs to the compact subgroup. Well, you can use that gauge freedom to go to the triangular gauge in which only the raising generators would appear and the Cartan generators, but you can get rid of the fields associated with the lowering operators. Then you can write the standard kinetic term, which is the invariant form on the group, and you project orthogonally to the subgroup by which you are taking the quotient. So that's a standard way of writing sigma model Lagrangian. And so you get a sigma model Lagrangian where the variables depend on time, but you have an infinite number of them. And the question is, what has this to do with supergravity? So on one side, we have a sigma model with an infinite number of variables depending only on time. And on the supergravity side, we have, of course, a finite number of fields, but they depend on more than one coordinate. And the idea is that there is a a correspondence between the supergravity fields expanded about one point. So we just consider one point in space, and we consider the fields at that point and all the successive gradients, so that would be an infinite collection. We might have also to add new degrees of freedom. The idea is that this thing should be equivalent to this infinite dimensional sigma model. Okay, now why do we say so? Let me consider, as I said, E10 for definiteness, which is the veil group of E10 is the veil group of the billiard corresponding to 11-dimensional supergravity. Well, it's to see whether this correspondence has a chance to fly. I will expand the roots of E10 according to the so-called level. Now, the level is the number of times this root occurs. So you see that in the algebra E10, there is a subalgebra which is finite dimensional, which is SL10 with this Dynkin diagram. And I will just expand the roots I will just count the number of times this particular root out of A9 occurs. And I call that the level. So I can expand the generators of the algebra according to the level, and this is what we find. Well, at level 0, of course, we get the positive roots of SL10. At level 1, well, you get something which, the nice thing of this is that you get things which fall into representations of SL10. Well, you find that at level 1, the generators of the algebra corresponding to level 1 roots form a representation of SL10, which is just the three-index antisymmetric representation. At level 2, you get a six-index antisymmetric field. At level 3, this is a problem of group theory, you get this representation of SL10. And, well, we will see that it's tempting to identify that with the metric and this with the three form of supergravity. And so, let me just write the dynamical equations of motion. So I write the group element in this triangular gauge as the exponential of something which is in the Cartan subalgebra plus something which contains these higher order fields. And I just write the sigma model equations of motion, expanding according to the level. And of course, I will have an infinite number of terms, which I've just written here, level 0, level 1, because it's an infinite dimensional space, so I have an infinite number of terms. And I want to compare that Lagrangian with the Lagrangian of supergravity. Now, to do that, I will truncate both sides, and I will try to refine the truncate, to make the truncation less and less stringent, but I will truncate both sides and see whether I can match. So, for instance, suppose I truncate the sigma model equations to level 0. So to level 0, I would have only the field corresponding to SL10. That will be the metric. I'm dropping all the other fields in the sigma model equations. And I want to compare that with what comes from supergravity. Well, I will also make a truncation here. I will assume that the metric is homogeneous in space, so the spatial gradients are zero. And if you do that, you can show that there is a perfect matching between what is left on this side and what is left on that side. So when you truncate, it's of course a drastic truncation on both sides, but if you truncate the sigma model equations to level 0 and you assume homogeneous fields on the supergravity side, then there is perfect matching. And also I'm assuming that the free form is 0. Now,
would that truncation for the walls disappear because there's no free form?
You would have only the symmetry walls, yes.
Only the symmetry walls?
Yes. Then the next level in order to compare is to make the truncation which is a bit less strong. And so I will keep on this side the level 1 field, and on this side, on the supergravity side, I will keep not only the metric, but I will also keep the three form, but I will assume that it depends only on time. So I would have an homogeneous electric field. then again, I can compare the equations of motion on both sides, what comes from supergravity, what comes from the nonlinear sigma model. And if I do that identification, I can see that there is a perfect matching between the level one equations of motion on this side and what comes from the supergravity equations of motion on the other side.
So what's the analog of the model of the walls from
For each level, I have a collection of roots and the corresponding walls. So they would correspond to exponential terms in the Lagrangian, which I will keep.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. We're not doing just geodesic motion, but we have a potential as well.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm truncating the theory and I'm dropping a lot of terms.
So how far do you have to go to get the space time curvature wall?
Okay, that's to level 3. And that's where the problems start. Okay, level 2 is still nice because there you can introduce some spatial gradients in the 3 form, and you assume that the 3 form contains a spatial gradient, but in such a way that the fields are homogeneous. So the magnetic field would not be zero, but depend only on time. So that would need a three form which depends on x, but in some very peculiar way, in such a way that the magnetic field itself does not depend on x. Now, if you compare this truncation of the nonlinear sigma model with the supergravity equations, assuming that you have only the metric, the electric field, the magnetic field, and that they depend only on time, again, you find a perfect matching between the equations of motion of the nonlinear sigma model and the equations of motion that come from supergravity. In particular, you also find that the Chern-Simons term that you have from the supergravity side and which is dictated by supersymmetry also comes here with a correct coefficient, but that's dictated by E10. So E10 has some group structures, so you would get a Lagrangian which follows from the nonlinear sigma model construction, and it will contain in particular the correct Chern-Simons term. Okay, then level 3, you would like to see some curvature. So you would truncate on this side. It's clear what you mean by truncation. What would that mean on the supergravity side? Well, you would like to introduce non-vanishing spatial derivatives of the metric, but not in a controlled way, because here you are it's a dramatic truncation, so you should also truncate here. And the way we have tried was to reduce on a non-abelian group manifold. So assume that there is some homogeneity group, but that the group is non-abelian. So in that case, you do get some spatial curvature. And again, you can compare the equations that you have on this side with the equations that you get on this side, and it works to some extent. So I will... In fact, there is a perfect match up to roots. So if I count things on the sigma model side, up to roots of 8.30. But above 8.30, which is actually where you start having imaginary roots from on the Kac-Moody side, then they start having, the equations of motion are not the same. So it works up to 8.30. And the question is, maybe we are we are using some dictionary. The way I have to tell you how the sigma model variables correspond to supergravity variables, and we may blame this on the dictionary that we have not correctly implemented.
Height of a root?
The height of a root is the number of times, the number of simple roots it contains.
Okay. Oh, okay. Is the difference just like maybe the imaginary roots? If you ignore the imaginary roots?
Okay, then actually you can show that if you ignore the imaginary roots, you can go above height 30, all the level 3 fields would match. Because, all real roots at level 3 match on both sides. But even though, so it starts well, it's promising, you get correctly, for instance, a Chern-Simons term, but, for the beyond height 30, or level 3, we don't know how the matching should go. So we need some good idea. at this stage. But I would like to conclude by saying something concerning quantum corrections. And again, I will only I will not say something very deep because we don't understand, but again, it's a very intriguing observation that somehow it appears that the quantum correction terms also have a group theoretical interpretation in terms of the algebra. So as it was observed, we cannot trust certainly the BKL analysis all the way to the singularity because the curvature blows, and then we have to take into account quantum corrections. And so, and that this work, that is ongoing work, but it started by Damour and Nicolai in the case of E10. You may try to see whether these quantum correction terms correspond to something from the point of view of the Kathmoody algebra. And to try to understand that question, you can analyze these terms using the BKL variable. So I will rewrite that in terms of the BKL scale factors variables, and there will be, before I reach the Planck regime, there will be a regime where the BKL analysis is valid, so I will do the same type of approximation, and then you can show that curvature terms of this type will be a sum of exponential terms with some coefficients involving linear forms in the scale factors. Okay, I'm just applying the BKL rules to analyze this thing. And now you might ask, do these linear forms have some meaning in terms of Kathmoody algebra? And it turns out that they correspond to weights of the overextended algebra. So they would be they would be linear combination of roots, which coefficients which might not be integers, but the thing is that they will always correspond to weights. So all known quantum corrections correspond to weights, and actually among these terms there will be one that blows up faster than the other. That leading term will correspond to a dominant weight. The dominant weight is one in the fundamental Weyl chamber. So now, if I look at these correction terms, it turns out that not all values of n and of the Dilaton coupling here would correspond to dominant weight. So there will be, so all known quantum corrections will correspond to weights, but there will be some there will be some values of lambda and n which might not correspond to weight. So for instance, let's take the most spectacular case, which is E10. There is no phi. You can show that it is only when n, the exponent of r, is 3k plus 1, that you get something which corresponds to a weight. So if you add another power of the curvature, r squared of r cubed, you would not get something which corresponds to a weight of the Kathmoody algebra. And so if you believe that the quantum correction should be compatible with the Kathmoody algebra, you would predict that these are the only possible quantum corrections. And I think that it's known that indeed things start at R4. I don't know how far people know about this expansion for M-theory, but at least it starts at R4. So I should also say that for E10, weights and roots are the same because E10 is a self-dual lattice. Actually, it's the only 10-dimensional Lorentzian self-dual lattice. But you can also consider other theories. For instance, if you take DE10 or BE10, which are relevant to 10-dimensional supergravities, so this would be without Maxwell, this would be pure supergravity, this would be supergravity with Maxwell with vector multiplets, well, you find that only some powers, so some loop orders are allowed for a given powers of the curvature. So you would find that at order n in the curvature, if you want things to be a dominant weight, so to be on the weight lattice and to correspond to a dominant weight, only tree, one loop, up to n minus one loop would be compatible with the Kathmoody symmetry. So it's interesting to see that the known quantum corrections fit in that sense with the Kathmoody structure which is seen by the Billiard, although what is the exact meaning of this is still work under study. So I would conclude here by saying that, well, this is very far from the original BKL result, but this BKL result has led to this Billiard, And these billiards have led to a conjecture G++ symmetry, where G++ is the overextension of this three-dimensional algebra. And attempts to exhibit this symmetry works for the lower levels, but do not work higher. It's much better than the billiard, because the billiard would correspond to simple roots, which are at height 1. But we can go beyond height 1. Well, height 30 is... So some of the curvature walls fit, some do not. Okay, actually, the dominant curvature walls fit. I did not discuss this, but the fermions can be included. They would form representations of K of the compact subgroup. Also, the quantum corrections seem to fit in a way that we don't understand, but at least there is a matching that can be done with the weight lattice with the algebraic structure. But certainly, the approach to exhibit this symmetry, if that symmetry is indeed relevant, is presumably too naive. It's probably not going to be a nonlinear sigma model. And so to go beyond that, if that is possible, well, we still need a good, or at least one good idea. So I will stop here. Yes?
So if this is a symmetry of string theory, you can also have brains extended over these directions. So have you guys looked at that?
Well, some... Well, people have studied whether brain solutions would correspond to representations of these algebras, and I think there are encouraging results as well there. I mean, some people. So, in a sense, you are studying things instead of time, using time. Time, you are taking some spatial coordinates as time, and it seems that they do get representations of. E10 or even E11, people have mentioned.
Something different. So you sort of have a generic flux configuration for various silicons and symmetry. If you have a generic brain configuration with brains extended in various directions, you'd also get potentials for the electrons. I wonder if you get any interesting structure from that. I'm not sure if that's the same.
I'm not sure. Well, I would say this has not been studied. I mean, this, maybe this should be explored. Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, I must say that one of the difficulties that we have, I think that the level, which is very nice from the point of view of the algebra, the level as defined here, so counting this root alpha naught, is a good number to study the dynamics of the nonlinear sigma model, but it's probably an awful quantum number on the string theory side. So it does not correspond to the mass level. And that's one of the difficulties. So it's very difficult to, and Hermann, we try to identify higher order states with higher order string states. And it's a nightmare, because I think the level is really, the level as used from the group theory side is a no-full quantum number from the string perspective.
Two quick questions. So. Just to make sure I understand, in the sigma model picture, there's no walls, right? You just have geodesic motion on this infinite dimensional homogeneous space.
That's right, but the space is curved. Hmm?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's curved. It's this group quotient, but there are no walls. It's just straight.
That's right, but if you project, okay, so one way to do, I mean, if you project to the Cartan subalgebra, the other terms would generate walls. It's like the Toda system. You can view it that way.
The other question was, when you were describing the connections between the sigma model and the supergravity, was that just for the 11-dimensional case? You kept going up to 3-4. Is it easier? I mean, can you consider like just 4 dimensions?
Yeah, it's just, you could consider 4 dimensions. But the problem with 4, I mean, is that you can do the same. The problem is that you, at level 0, you have homogeneous gravity that works fine. But at level 1, you have already the curvature walls. And the curvature walls are really, I mean, this is the level where you start having difficulty. So it's less spectacular because, so it's better to have forms, because with form it works level 1, level 2. You get problems at level 3. When the curve, actually, you get the problems where the curvature, spatial curvature terms are present. G
you're trying to understand how to solve the problem of the curvature, you might like it to appear sooner.
Yes.
And it might be easier to sort of understand.
That's right.
And also the physics is there. I mean, it sounds like you run into mathematical difficulty just where the physics becomes interesting.
Yeah, just E10 is a nice structure, but it's true. Then you would have the overextension of A1. So you have the garage group, which is A1 affine, and then A1 overextended would be the relevant group here, quotientized by its maximal compact subgroup. So indeed, that's something that can be at least written. Well, this is due to the algebra. In a sense, that also depends on how you define the level. I mean, I could have decomposed E10 differently. It is at the level where the affine root appears, of the highest root, sorry, appears.
Mm-hmm. On the issue of quantum corrections, there's some work, I guess, by Bojewal, that he looks at the loop quantum gravity versions of homogeneous spacetime. Does that quantum version of singularities fit into the algebraic structure that you're using, or does it not have?
Not in any obvious way.
The symmetry, the answer is G plus one, so for extension. Which of course contains the rhythm of the garage group and the original GF, assuming subgroups, or sub-algebras. So do we understand any sense in which G itself, or just G plus, is a symmetry of the full supergravity group?
Yeah, that's a good question and a difficult one, because it presumably acts in a non-local way. But so we don't really, I mean, people have tried. And so you might say, I see E8 down in three dimensions. Can I write E8 acting on supergravity variables in 11 dimensions? So some people have tried with no success so far. But we are, in a sense, even more ambitious. But OK, but that's a good thing. Yeah, that's. The problem is that if it works, it will be highly non-local.
Your correspondence would expect to be local?
No, I'm not. No, and I think we don't know what would be the higher level fields in terms of the sigma model, in terms of the supergravity fields. Presumably, these are non-local constructs out of the supergravity field.
So far, you've just done a derivative expansion. Yes.
But this fails at some point, so which means that this naive derivative expansions is probably not correct.
But it's also true that in some sense you could end up to a stage where the non-trivial derivative expansion that anything can be described in terms of projection on homogeneous spaces.
Yes. And it's difficult, I mean, it's not easy to see what is between the full theory and homogeneous spaces. I should say that the interesting thing about the quantum corrections is that they are associated in the case of E10 with imaginary roots. And so this is really the first case where imaginary roots seems to play a role. Okay, when I did this expansion and compared Lagrangians, it's when we get to the first level where imaginary roots are present that we get into troubles. Here, these quantum corrections are associated with imaginary roots, and I think that's interesting. Yes. Yeah, so I think that's probably an indicator, and that's why the BKL behavior will be destroyed as you go to the singularity.
Yeah, once you start having these imaginary groups, do you have any idea if the space still becomes
if you take into account the
imaginary roots?
Well, I don't know. I mean, who knows? I think probably it's much more dramatic than this. I think that this BKL picture will be destroyed. So I think that the important lesson, and this is why we are interested in that, is more the symmetry structure that it seems to reveal, rather than the BKL structure itself, which I think quantum mechanically will not survive. But
well, but also, I mean, you know, quantum corrections are like the theater chips, and you can't touch just one.
You need all of them. That's right.
That eight quantum correction comes in, they all come in.
They all come in, that's right. That's why it's difficult to analyze a problem.
And I'll just remind you that tomorrow.